Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before I get into my amazing guest this week and fighting back from Mount Everest, coming off that insane mountain and starting to gain the pounds back and jumping back into the podcast game, I do want to remind everybody to go to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. And there's lots of stuff going on, including all the latest updates from what happened on the mountain, the big journey, the last actually 9 years to cover seven summits. And also all these amazing podcasts. I've now done well over 200 of these things. We've got over 100,000, 120,000 downloads. And so I'm very grateful and appreciative. And again, please continue to give a ratings and review to the pods on iTunes. That's how more people get exposed to these incredible people doing amazing things. Also, I continue to fundraise for Higher Ground, Amelia's Everest. We keep charging forward. That thing did not end. Very fortunate. The NFL is going to throw in more money. And so any contribution you can do would be greatly appreciated. And now we're pointing our mission towards this September, where the NFL is doing a film documentary. We will keep you posted on the website, but there is a philanthropy tab there and you can go in and learn all about what we're up to. More information is coming on that. So on that note, I want to get into the podcast. So I want to give a setup. So I was invited to a celebrity golf tournament, literally coming off the mountain of Mount Everest. And so I met a lot of really cool people. And as I just said, there was a celebrity attached to it. And one of the guys I met in the lobby of our hotel was Trent Dimas. He's an amazing guy. He is an incredible gymnast, gold medalist back in 92. Okay, I got that right. So first of all, Trent, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mark. I appreciate it. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was great because, I've in my past, I'm sure like you, from playing in the NFL, playing at the highest level of college football, climbing mountains all over the world, I've done a number of these different events, and sometimes you run into divas, and that's just not a great place to be, right? And especially when people act like that, and you were sort of normalized and really kind of understood the game of life. And probably the thing that I was most impressed with you, and we're going to get into your amazing career, but, you know, I want to start kind of forward and then go back. But, you know, your commitment to your longtime wife, your commitment to your kids, the things that you want to do. And so really, as we age, we hopefully that we all grow, we all evolve. And you definitely have your priorities in line in terms of what matters most, your family and your friends. And that was just really cool because I'm in that same boat with you. But where did you learn that? You must have had a really stable environment with your parents or some kind of mentors that really helped guide the light.
You know, I would say it was my parents. We were a very close-knit family. Grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, in the high deserts of the Rocky Mountains. And there really wasn't a lot to do in New Mexico. And my parents were just instrumental in being right next to us. And I look back at my career, and I would say that my mother or my father were literally at every single competition and every single workout. And that, I mean, we're not talking about, oh, hey, let's have a workout three times a week. Gymnastics is one of those sports where you are 51 weeks a year, you are twice a day, you are 8 hours a day. And my parents were constantly there. And when you see your parents working so hard, you know that there's a responsibility. It's a reciprocal responsibility. They're providing for you, and you have to make good on that. And so it was definitely an example for me to follow. And now I just literally had a conversation with somebody the other day who said, "Hey, what's going on with your career? What are you going to do? Are you going to go into politics back in New Mexico?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure the timing is right." And he said, "Give me a break." He's like, "The timing is right." And I said, "Well, my son needs me. He's 14. I feel like I need 4 more years with him. And I'm just not going to give that up." And there was a delayed response. And he came back and said, "Sounds like you've got the right things in the right order." So that here we are. It's an important thing. You've got to have that base. And I hope I'm providing that to my kids.
Yeah. Well, I know you are, because I met them both. They're both wonderful kids. And I know your daughter's going off to, I think, New York City next year at NYU. Yep. So you guys have done a great job with her. And it always takes a village too. So, you know, certainly you're a big part of that. Your wife is a huge part of that. And I'm sure your extended family, you know, have some piece in that. But so I'm trying to think about, you know, I grew up with kind of the big three sports, okay? Football, basketball, and baseball. Soccer, maybe a little bit, maybe that was more of a girl sport back in the day. And so, you know, I'm trying to sit back in my chair and I'm thinking about like how not only does somebody get involved in gymnastics, especially a guy, because I always associate that more with more the girls, right? Of doing tumbling and those things that you were starting to talk about. But then in all places, New Mexico, right? And so,
yeah, like, absolutely.
Right. Like, how does New Mexico fit in that? And what kind of programs? And a lot of this is I've been through New Mexico and I've been to Albuquerque, but I'm not an expert in the state by any means. But like, how did that all form? I mean, was there somebody that encouraged you to go down that path versus, say, you know, the traditional sports that are out there today? I mean, and the thing is, for gymnasts, you've actually got good size. A lot of gymnasts are much smaller, and you know, you've got good height on you. So, like, where did that all come together?
Well, I think we start at the beginning, and our parents homeschooled us. My brother and I were a couple of the first kids in the country to be homeschooled. And it was an odd thing because we always had the neighbors calling the police. They would show up at the door and they would be like, "Why aren't your kids in school?" And, you know, but my parents didn't want us to be social invalids. So, I mean, we spoke German. I don't speak a word of it except Guten Tag now. We did karate. We played. My dad was a soccer coach. And we stumbled into a community center that was very close to our house. And I still remember the first day the coach said, "Well, what can you do?" And then he was kind of a loud guy. And then he yelled, "What can you do?" And I jumped up and I fell on my back and I started kind of convulsing. And he said, "Well, you know, you don't have any talent, but at least you listen. So maybe you have a future." And as we progress at this community center, my brother and I both started it together and we made it to a state competition. And the coach from the community center didn't show up. So my dad went to one of the other coaches that was there and said, "Hey, would you coach my kids?" And this guy was a gymnast, not a great gymnast. And I think you'll find that most of the best coaches in the world were not gymnasts, but technically they're just good. And this guy, Ed Birch, out of New Mexico, born and raised there, has had more male Olympians than any private gym in the country. So he has a talent for honing in on the qualities that make athletes great. Do we agree with them all today? I would say yes, but boy, I'll tell you, in today's environment, it's tough to be the best in the world and not get a little bit of ridicule. But it's, as you know, you've got to be mentally tough. You've got to be physically tough. And at the end of the day, you have to be willing to do what other people aren't. And there is no guarantee that you will succeed. None at all. You have to just throw it out all there on the table and hope that something comes together.
Yeah, I found the same thing when I transitioned from high school up into that point. I could kind of do whatever I wanted to do on the football field. And then when I got into to college, it was like a big bucket of cold water that was dumped in my head. And once I kind of figured out that I needed to really apply commitment and discipline to put myself in a position, I mean, there was no guarantee on the other side. It took me 3 years, and there was a lot of dark moments. It took me 3 years before I finally got my opportunity. And then when that happened, I was in the right place at the right time and did the right things and delivered that allowed me to go on and play and be a starter and all those things. But like you said, you know, you just got to make up your mind, like, what do you want to be? Where do you want to go? And it sounds like you did that. I want to go back to a comment that you made earlier, and you said that you were one of the first, you and your brother were one of the first kids in the country to be homeschooled. I'm wondering why that was. What was it about your community or the school system or your parents' beliefs that they even came up with this idea? I mean, I've never heard of the word homeschool until I was much later in life. I started having kids. You know, because we just went, you know, you're kindergarten, you go to kindergarten.
That's a great question. So there's no doubt that New Mexico, unfortunately, I mean, it is one of the best places in the world. Great weather, 325 days of sun a year. It's altitude. It's got the perfect climate, but it lacks some of the things. And where it's great in some areas, it's horrible in others. And education is one of those places that it just doesn't meet even par or close to. As a matter of fact, it's nearing some of the worst states in the U.S. But as it relates to my parents, my dad wanted to go to colleges, and he wanted to speak to people about Christ. And so they were always throwing us in the car with a couple of people from our church, and they would, you know, go to from campus to campus and talk to college students. And, you know, because we were traveling quite a bit, that was just something that they wanted to do. And as a matter of fact, it turned out to be one of the best things ever, because my brother and I were also some of the first kids in gymnastics to begin training twice a day because our schedule was flexible. Today, I would say the majority of female gymnasts and maybe even some of the male gymnasts, they're all being homeschooled because now instead of putting in 3 or 4 hours a day in the evening, you can put in 8 hours or 6 hours by splitting it up and you can get better results. But that was the main reason for my parents, is they wanted to go out and kind of change the hearts and minds of people with kind of teaching why are we here? Where are we going? What is the meaning of life? And that letting people know that they're loved. And I think that permeated into who we were as a family.
So there's no question that you were, you know, you had an aptitude towards gymnastics, fearless, athletic. You could do all those things. You make the U.S. junior team when you're 13 and the senior national team when you're 15. During that period of time, as you're making these teams, did that also include now that you're traveling around the country and competing in these national events?
It was. But what was interesting about that is I think you give me a lot more credit than I was due. There were so many top talented, excellent gymnasts all over the country. And I was one of the borderline guys. If there was a team that made six, I was either fifth, sixth, seventh. I was either right in or right out. Nobody ever looked at me and said, "Hey, that guy is so talented." But, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier about my height. Now I'm wholly average, but for a gymnast, I'm a monster. I'm very tall. And it makes a difference when you're as tall as I am, because it changes the trajectory of how you can flip and twist and how you can turn your body. The smaller you are, the lighter you are, the easier it is to lift your body, the easier it is to twist, the easier it is to flip. And I don't have that. So as I was coming through the ranks, I couldn't use what other kids were using. They were using pure muscle to go through things. So biomechanically, I had to learn everything perfect. I had to use swing. I had to use my body in a much different way. And so when that caught up to my strength in my early, in, you know, my late teens and my early 20s, it really catapulted me onto the scene.
Incredible. So now you're out there. You obviously had made a name for yourself. And And somehow or another, you get a full ride scholarship to, again, to me, I just don't think of Nebraska as being a powerhouse in gymnastics, but you end up going to Lincoln, Nebraska. I've been there, and it's in the middle of a cornfield, and you know, it's a cool school and everything. But how did that whole process come about?
Well, 89, I was the number one recruit in the country. I could have went anywhere, and I probably would have ended up at UCLA, but for my father. And I asked him, well, what do you think I should do? And he said, brothers should be together and you should follow your brother and be with him. And there's strength in numbers and you should go to Nebraska. And that was a pretty, they had won four or five national championships in 84. They had Jim Hartung, Phil Cahoy on the Olympic team. So they were a powerhouse. Francis Allen and Jim Howard, their coaching ability was unsurpassed. And really what they taught their athletes was consistency. And I didn't know it at the time, but that's what I needed. I was I did some good gymnastics, but I wasn't in a competition and really just got the routines at a perfect level. And so that's what Nebraska taught me. But I'll tell you, it was a great year. Because I didn't finish at Nebraska, and I was on full scholarship. We were the NCAA champions. I was an anchor on the team. We only won by 1/10 of a point that year, but there was something kind of pulling at me that said, "Can you make an Olympic team here?" I mean, I just didn't know if I could do it. And the year after we won the NCAA championships, I came home to Albuquerque, New Mexico during the summer. And it was probably the hardest decision of my life to decide whether or not to train for the Olympics or stay at the University of Nebraska and follow the many, many, many greats and Olympians by going through their system.
Mm. Interesting. Nonetheless, you do move on from Nebraska. And so as you're thinking about this now, going to train, what was the plan to go and find the superstar coach that's going to help you realize these dreams?
I would say it was complete and utter ignorance or 100% divine intervention, because if knowing what I know now, would I have made the same decision? Absolutely not. I would have finished my education, because there was nothing wrong with Nebraska. As a matter of fact, I loved being there. And everybody, all my teammates at the time thought that I hated Nebraska, that I hated the team. And that was the reason why I was leaving. And it couldn't have been further from the truth. But there was something that was important. I didn't know if I could go. I had already missed the 88 Olympic team. 92 was there. I was the perfect age. 96, I was probably a little bit too old. And again, my body was taking quite a bit of punishment. Plus, when you're in college, as you well know, there's the partying, there's the girls, there's the competition and the school. And how do you split your time up? How do you focus your time into one thing? And I just didn't believe I could do it. But I'll tell you, it was one tough decision. And the main reason why it was so difficult was because my brother was still there. And I knew that if I left, he would really take the brunt of all the anger that came along with my departure.
Hmm. Is that the way it played out?
In spades. Yeah. In spades. My brother was, treated poorly, to say the least. There was a kind of right at the coach's door. There were some cartoons that they used to put up on the wall, and most of them were about me. And you have to imagine for a moment that there was nobody in the United States at that time who had left a college scholarship to train for the Olympics. The normal routine was you go from high school, your private club, to college, you do your 4 years at college, then you train for the Olympics. Nobody had taken this path at that point. And I had done something that was wholly different. So it wasn't just the University of Nebraska. I would say 80 to 90% of the college coaches in this country wanted me to fail because it went against everything that they had set up for decades. And I was just a different athlete. There was nothing wrong with their system. It's just that their system didn't work for me. And when I left, it was a very, very difficult situation because I had turned the entire NCAA program really against me. And when gymnastics isn't track and field, it's not swimming, it's not against the clock, it is subjective. So you've got all of these coaches who are politicking with the judges and they're looking at you. And, you know, if somebody likes you, you might get an extra 10th. Well, that can make the difference between being second in the country and seventh.
Crazy. In one sense, you were kind of like a one and done, you know, as they refer to those things now, really for the, in the, you know, college basketball into the NBA. I don't think you and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and I'm just kind of relating to your story. When I came out of the NFL, I was recruited by the U.S. national handball team to go and try out and be part of their travel team, whatever you want to call it, as they develop their talent. And they're definitely looking to upgrade. It's a wonderful sport. I don't think a lot of people in the U.S. know about it. It's big in Switzerland and other places within Europe. And it's a super fun game. And at the end of the day, you know, I just had some people say, look, going from the NFL down to this, and, you know, we haven't been the strongest team. There's a lot of risk involved. And so I decided to opt out and not go do that. And I don't know if that would have was the best decision or not, but, you know, you're going all over, going to the Pan Am games, you're doing a lot of those different things. And as it turned out in the Atlanta games, I think it was 1996, they finished last. So maybe it was a good decision that I didn't, but it takes going back to that, you know, you got to have a team, you got to have, you know, you got to be full in and, you know, you just can't have one foot in, one foot out. So when you decided to not go back to Nebraska, to go all in, despite, you know, that's a lot of just tuning out the negative noise and focusing just on the task at hand, what you want to do and your end goal was going to the Olympics. So let me ask you this. So things are starting to go well and you're training, you know, you make this decision, your hard decision, your brother's still in Nebraska. He's feeling some grief, but nonetheless, you know, you plow forward, you've got the right coach. You're in the right environment. And now we come down to the U.S. Olympic trials. So we actually, as we speak today, they're going through a lot of that right now as they ramp up for Tokyo in terms of picking those participants that are going to play, be involved in what's going to go on there. But for you, I think they were going to take the top six spots, and that's what was going to make up the Olympic team. We haven't talked about this yet, but when you go to make a gymnastics team, are you actually doing all six different events? Is it six? And are you doing all six, or you have a specialty and that's what you do?
Well, gymnastics is transitioned to a more of a specialty type of sport rather than an all-around sport. When I did it, you were not only required to do all six events, the floor exercise, the pommel horse, the still rings, vaulting, parallel bars, and high bar. You are also expected to do two different types of routines. One was a compulsory routine, which is the same routine that everyone in the world did to see who was the very best when they all were doing the same skills. And then there was an optional routine, your own made-up routine that was based on a set of regulations and rules that you followed that you could then reach a 10.0. So it is wholly different now than it was then. In addition to that, when we competed at the Olympic trials, there were two competitions. There was the U.S. Championships that was worth 40% and the Olympic Trials that was worth 60%. If you blew one event at either one of those competitions, you were gone. Didn't matter if you were the best gymnast in the world. Today, and I would say since probably 96, the team is selected. Now, competition does play a part in that, but it's more of a selection procedure. And I think that I don't feel so somebody like myself would never have been on an Olympic team because you have to have people like you. You can't do things that are out of the norm. And I certainly was out of the norm. And so it is different. There's just no wild cards today. There's nobody that gets in there that comes out of nowhere. And that was definitely my case, but you mentioned something earlier. You said things were going great. I was in a place where I was focused, but man, I'll tell you, being in a college system where everything is taken care of for you is a cocoon. Going back to New Mexico was very, very difficult. And as a matter of fact, in 1990, when I made the decision to leave Nebraska, I was number 4 in the country. In 1991, I dropped to number 11. Oh. And they only paid the top 10 athletes. And I was making $10,000 a year, but they were only paying the top 10 athletes. And it was in U.S. championships in 1991, just 1 year before the Olympic Games, that I finished right out of the money. And I remember being in Albuquerque. I had actually called Jim Howard, who was the assistant coach at the University of Nebraska, probably 2 o'clock in the morning. And I said, Jim, I think I made a huge mistake. I don't think this is right. I'm confused about the decision that I made. And he said, nope, you made your bed, so now you need to sleep in it. Mm-hmm. And, U.S. championships that year was tough, thinking I'd made a horrible decision. And I remember being at home. I went to the mailbox one day and I had, I didn't have a lot of bills, but at 20 years old, if you've got $600 in bills, you're drowning. Yeah. And I remember going, Bill, Bill, Bill. And then I saw this envelope and it was a baseball bat with two bats through it. And I was like, what the heck is this? And I open it up and there's a letter and out falls a check. And of course I pick up the check and the check was for $5,000. And I was like, what? So I read the letter and it says, I saw you in the U.S. championships and I saw that your vault, and I had a horrible vault where I basically missed the whole vault and landed on my neck and nearly killed myself. And then I went back up and did it again and finished 11th in that competition, not top 10, but 11th. And Steinbrenner said, I saw what you did. I admire the work that the way you got back up there. Here's $5,000. I hope it helps you in your Olympic quest, George Steinbrenner. And it was a shocker to have somebody of that stature to believe in, a nobody from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it was definitely a shot in the arm that helped me kind of move forward and get to the next level.
So I think the reference you're talking about, George Steinbrenner, was the former owner of the New York Yankees, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's an amazing story. Okay, so let's get into it. Let's get into the fun stuff. So you make the team, right?
Whoa, you can't miss Olympic trials because there's a key component at the Olympic trials.
Let's talk about the Olympic trials.
So, so basically you compete, and there's really only one quintessential thing here. And that is you compete, you make the top 6, you make the Olympic team. This year, 68 guys, something like that, go to the nationals, 18 go to the Olympic trials, 6 make the Olympic team. Well, out of the 18 guys that make it to Olympic trials, 6-8 guys are from the University of Nebraska. Mm. So the U.S. Gymnastics Federation does something they'd never done before. They select the coach before they select the team. And guess who they selected? The coach from the University of Nebraska.
Yeah.
So, and as it turns out, I was the only gymnast that had a Nebraska connection that made the team. So it was a very rocky road with having the head coach of the Olympic team being from the University of Nebraska, and the kind of, probably the residual anger that he probably had toward me played a part in a great many things that had happened at the Olympics, but it all ended up well.
Well, no, it ended up phenomenal for you. I mean, it's just, you're going there just to do your best, and through all the hard work, the preparation, you stepped up and you delivered with a gold medal performance. And I want you to describe that because I saw the clip that you sent. And for anybody that's listening, please go to YouTube and Google Trent Dimas, D-I-M-A-S. And you got to see this routine because it's so flawless. And I would imagine, I mean, there's a lot of hard parts in that routine, but ultimately, you know, when you do your dismount and you're flying through the air and you're flipping and twisting and everything, when you land, you just land, you nailed it. I mean, boom. And you just stuck on the ground like you had glue on your feet. And just, I've seen enough Olympics and seen enough athletes that so many times the momentum of coming off, you know, you land and then take a little bunny hop, bunny step, anything just to kind of get your balance back. Cause you just, you know, you're flying through the air. And to watch you drill that was really exciting. So I'm interested in the performance and what your mind, you know, like what was going through your head when you stepped up, pressure packed. Were you behind at that time? Did you need a certain score at that time? Or were you just in the middle of the pack and it just all worked out?
Well, great question. And let me start at about 3 o'clock that day. I think it was August, early August, maybe August 12th, somewhere right around that. It's through, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You leave from the Olympic Village, you take a bus. It's not very far, but it takes you a couple hours to get to the gym because of the traffic in Barcelona. You arrive at the Palau Sant Jordi. You get 2 hours to warm up. Competition starts about 7, but I'm only doing one event. In the Olympic order, high bar is the last event in the Olympic order. And out of randomness, I end up being the second to last athlete on high bar. So you warm up. It takes a couple hours.
So in this case, sorry to interrupt, but in this case, is that seen as an advantage?
It's definitely seen as, yeah, no, going last or close to last is definitely seen as an advantage because in gymnastics, or at least how it used to be, judges don't really want to give too high of a score too early. Now they'll give lower scores, but they don't want to give a 10.0. And in those days, it was you were still working on the 10.0 platform. So you don't want to give a 9.95 or something like that, because then there's where you're going to go. You know, next one is a 10. And then if somebody else is better than him, well, you can't go over 10.
Yeah.
So you do want to be last, you want to be close to it. And that was just by luck of the draw. And so that was fortunate for me. So we have three guys in finals. Chris Waller, who's on pommel horse, Jair Lynch, who's on parallel bars, and myself on high bar. And so each event is, God, it's just taking forever. And now they split up. At the Olympics, they do like two events at a time instead of all of them in one night. So the first two events come on. They start at 7. It's like, you know, 8:30. They do the awards for those two events, and they do the next two events. And then they finish parallel bars. And gosh, it's already after 11:30 at night. And I'm in the warm-up gym and I've been there for 5 hours. And of course, by now I'm getting a little bit more relaxed because I've been sitting around forever. And somebody knocks on the door to the practice gym, and in walks the men's program committee director from USA Gymnastics. And that his name was Robert Cowan. And he said, how are you feeling? And I said, well, I'm feeling pretty good. I think we're going to be going up pretty soon. And he says, great, great. I'm so glad you're feeling good because you're our last hope for a gold medal. I thought, you got to be joking me. Do I need more pressure than that? I know this is the Olympics. This is it. So he leaves and I can start. You can already start feeling your heart pumping and, you know, you're getting sweaty palms. Mm-hmm. A few minutes later, Beth Rujak from NBC Sports, and she was kind of the on-ground reporter in interviewing the athletes. And she comes in and she's like, Trent, how are you doing? How are you feeling? I said, I was fine until Robert came in and he told me that I was the last hope for a medal. And she said, don't worry about that at all, but I've got a bit of good news for you. We've decided to run gymnastics live back in the United States, and we're going to shape the whole show around you. I thought, you got to be, I mean, that kind of pressure is just something that I'd never had, mm-hmm. I'd never wanted. And it just adds a lot of color to your performances. So here I am. I mean, it's just after midnight. I walk out onto the podium and the events today, they put them on like a stage. And so the only people that are up there are the coach and the athlete. But I'm the only gymnast out of the eight guys that are in finals that can actually jump to the high bar by himself. Everybody else is, you know, 5'2", 5'3". Mm-hmm. And the bar is at 9 feet, you know. So I'm the only guy that can really jump up there by himself. And you get what they call a one touch. And that means you get to get up there for 30 seconds. You do whatever you want. You hop off. I used to do this double flip over the bar. I'm swinging in a circle. I let go in the front of the bar. I do two flips over the bar. And on the way down, I catch the bar. Well, in my one touch, I caught the bar, but I caught it with my chin. Mm. And I just thought to myself, oh my gosh, it's over. It's over. And so you sit there and you just wait. And I never, athletes, never have. And I always keep my head down. I go through my routine mentally. If I mess up in my head, I start over. And it was a real nerve-wracking time because you're sitting there and you can hear the bar bending, and you hear the crowd going, wow, whoa. And then you hear a thump and the crowd goes wild. And you think, okay, somebody just went. Yeah. And then somebody just went. And the guy who was just before me was a world champion, Li Jing from China. And I mean, this guy was substantial in his own right. Definitely somebody that could win the Olympic Games. But an interesting factor on this was there were no American judges on the event. And that was something that could have definitely hurt me. That means you had no help. You don't, you know, you've got the head judge was Eberhard Ginger, who was from Germany. Andreas Wecker, who was also from Germany, great high bar man, gold medalist in Atlanta. He placed actually second in this event, but he had a 9.837. And he was tied with Grigory Masutin from the unified team, the former Soviet Union. So those two guys were in first, and up comes Li Jing. And Li Jing is, you know, he's doing his routine and I can hear it. And all of a sudden I hear this thump and I look up and he's on the ground and I'm like, oh my gosh. So.
So when you say he was on the ground, meaning he fell or he landed?
He fell. He did his double front flip over the high bar and missed the bar. I mean, you can be off a couple of millimeters and he's on the ground. And the interesting thing about competition is, and the podium that you're competing on is there's a scoreboard, and on that is a red light and a green light. And when the green light goes on, you're allowed to walk up onto the podium. And so he gets up there. He doesn't finish his routine because he knows he can't win. So he just does his dismount. That's it. And the judges can't figure out his score because he's missing like half of his routine. And I'm standing on the podium by myself for probably 5 or 6 minutes. And that is just the loneliest time ever because you're thinking to yourself, oh my God, this is it. This is the Olympics. What if I screw up? Well, maybe if I just hold back ever so slightly, maybe I can win a bronze medal, or what do I do? And I remember going through my mind and going through my routine, and I looked up at the high bar, and sometimes I look at the high bar as I'm doing my routine. And right behind the high bar was this huge scoreboard with Grigory Masutin and Andreas Wecker with a 9.837. And I put my head down and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to score a 10 to win. And finally, the score came up for Li Jing, and it was like a 6.425. Mm-hmm. And that was a horrible score because, again, as you alluded to earlier, going later in the lineup is better because scores get higher and higher and higher as they go on. And all of a sudden, he broke the momentum and he was down at a 6.425. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, I'm just so nervous. I thought I was going to blow it. And then I bowed my head and I just prayed and I said, Lord, this is for you. And I saluted the judge and I jumped up onto the high bar, and it was truly like an out of body experience. It never had I been in this kind of situation before where I was literally talking to myself during this routine. I was thinking, wow, I did this. Wow, I did this. And I had that big double flip over the high bar where I caught my chin during the one touch and I caught it perfectly. And I said, oh my God. And then I had two more release moves and I caught them. And I remember swinging, thinking it's all going to come down to this dismount. And you'll notice that today people really don't do the triple somersault anymore because you have so much momentum, about 10,000 pounds of pressure per square inch as you're landing. And then you have the momentum going backwards, 2,000 pounds of pressure. And so if I'm swinging on the high bar and I say, 1, 2, 3, open, 1, 2, 3, open, that means I've let go of the bar, I've done three flips, and the floor should be right beneath me. 1, 2, 3, open. That's how quick you can do a triple somersault. Winding up, I go to the bar, and I said, 1, 2, 3, open, and I open, and I stuck my landing. And unlike Grigori Masutin, who took a step backwards, or Andreas Wecker, who took a hop forward, I stuck my landing. And I just said, oh my God. And I literally just ran and jumped off the podium and bear hugged my coach, arms and legs like a fool. Yeah. And, you know, just enjoyed the moment for what it was. Not that I had believed that I had won, but that I had did the best possible routine, leaving everything out there, no matter what, for the right reason. And, you know, in my opinion, for the glory of God. And whatever the score was going to be the score. And it was so cool because these scoreboards were these older kind of ticker tape type of scoreboards. And it was right behind us. And I remember looking up as the judges were calculating my score. And then you saw the first two guys that were tied for first. You just see their names drop down. Shunk, and you heard that noise. And you were like, oh my gosh, did I just move into first place in the world? And it was just amazing. It was amazing.
Well, you did your best when your best was required. And certainly when you're going through those moments, you know, just before you got on the high bar, you got in the zone. And, you know, it really doesn't matter how you get there. Sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. But you were able to capture that one moment in time. And the beautiful thing is, you know, you own that moment for the rest of your life. So now you get a gold medal. And I want to fast forward. I know there's so much detail about the emotion, and especially when you jumped in the arms. I saw that to your coach, and I've had those moments myself where you turn out to be the hero for that one moment in time, and that's an amazing feeling. I want to fast forward though to you're on this high, and now of course you're America's darling, and now the Today Show wants to have you on. And you're late to the appearance. And I think if I read this right, the gold medal came off your neck from the ribbon that goes around and drops to the ground and gets scuffed up a little bit. And what your decision process was after that, should you get it fixed or just leave it as it is?
Well, yeah, I was running to do my interview with Katie Couric and on the Today Show. They had like these rooms where all the athletes could get snacks. And I remember sitting there, I literally sat there by myself all night long, staring out the window. And so, because I couldn't believe it, what had just happened to me. And so I was late to my interview. And so I was running and it wasn't the actual strap. I had put my gold medal in another pouch because I didn't want to scratch it. I didn't want to ding it. I didn't want anything to happen to it. And I put it in another pouch around my neck. And as I was running, it was bouncing. And it snapped the strap and tink, 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 tink. And I was like, oh, slow motion. And I pull it out of this package and I see all these dents on it. I'm like, oh, I can't believe I ruined the one day after I win it, I ruined the medal. But, you know, it's a story. And I'll always remember running to go do that interview. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to leave it. It's going to be kind of a representation of my athletic career. It's gold, but there are a lot of dings along the way.
I love it. I love it. And that's just, you know, again, going back to really loving the process and sticking with it, and you go through all your adversity. And that's, again, so much what this show is about. I mean, you won the gold medal and that's amazing, but nobody really understands all the heartache that you had to go through. And, you know, it served you well going forward where you are today and the decisions that you've made and your commitment to your family, to your wife, to your kids on what you want to do so they can be the best that they can be. And that is something to be admired, you know, from a lot of people. So I appreciate, you know, sharing that with us. So I want to encourage everybody to go check out this video, Trent Demas on YouTube. You can see this performance. It's once in a lifetime. And so glad that we were able to connect in Mississippi. Sounds like we might be going there again this next year, which I'm really jacked up. So we can have more fun together on the golf course and getting to know each other. So Trent, thank you so much for coming on the show and good luck to you in your future. Okay. Thank you so much.
Mark, thank you. I really appreciate being on the show and congratulations to you on Everest. I can tell you that only a few special people do that. And you're one of those people. And it's amazing. It was a pleasure to meet you and the accomplishments that you've had in your life are just beyond. I mean, they're just beyond normal.
No, I appreciate that. Appreciate that. And again, it's a village. Certainly there's been a lot of people, a lot of help along the way. So on that note, thank you so much. He is the one, the only Trent Demas. Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Attention parents and grandparents. If you're looking for a gift that's more than just a toy, give them something that inspires confidence and adventure all year long. Give them a Guardian bike, the easiest, safest, and number one kids bike on the market. With USA-made, kid-specific frames and patented safety technology, kids are learning to ride in just one day. No training wheels needed. It's why Guardian is America's favorite kids bike and the New York Times and Wirecutter's top pick 3 years in a row. This holiday season, Guardian is offering their biggest deal of the year. Up to 40% in savings on all bikes, plus $100 in free accessories. Guardian bikes have become the most sought-after gifts of the season. And inventory is going fast, so don't wait. Join over 500,000 happy families who've discovered the magic of Guardian. Shop now at guardianbikes.com. That's guardianbikes.com.